We'll get started so we can make the best use of our time.
Part of it.
We're going to begin the public input hearing for docket HP09-001, and that deals with the application made by TransCanada Keystone Pipeline for a permit under the South Dakota Energy Conversion and Transmission Facility Act. And as you all know, what they want to do is they want to construct the Keystone XL pipeline. So today's date is April 27th, 2009. The time is a little bit after noon, and this is the time and place for our hearing here at Winter. This hearing concerns the application for that project. Now, we've got two main purposes for this hearing. The first is to provide information to the public about this project, and the second is to take public comment about the project. Interested persons have the right to present their views and comments regarding the application, and the Commission sincerely wants to encourage you to do so. A copy of the application is on file with the Harding, Butte, Perkins, Meade, Pennington, Hawken, Jones, Lyman, and Tripp County auditors. And the public may also access the application and all other non-confidential documents in the file on the Commission's website at www.puc.sd.gov. Now, the parties to the proceeding at this time are the Commission and the applicant. Under South Dakota law, each municipality, county, and governmental agency in the area where the facility is proposed to be constructed, or any interested person or entity, may be granted party status in this proceeding by making a written application to the Commission on or before May 11th, 2009. I also want to make it clear, though, that you don't have to be an intervener, a legal intervener, in order to have your voice heard on this topic. Public comments today, any written comments we receive, those all go into the file and are instructive to the commissioners as they make their deliberations. And we do have applications available this afternoon if you do want to apply for legal party status. For the permit to be approved, the applicant must show that the proposed Keystone XL project will do four things. First, that it will comply with all applicable laws and rules. Secondly, that the Keystone XL project will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment or to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants in the siting area. Third, that the project will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants. And fourth, that the Keystone XL project will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region, with due consideration having been given to the views of governing bodies of affected local units of government. Based on these factors, the commission, which is made up of myself, Dusty Johnson, as well as Commissioners Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen, will have three options. The first option would be to deny the permit. The second would be to approve the permit. Or the third would be to approve the permit with certain terms, conditions, and modifications of the construction, operation, or maintenance of the facilities as the Commission finds appropriate. So we're going to begin the hearing this afternoon by having the applicant make a 30 to 35 minute presentation so we all have the same foundation and knowledge about the project. And then following that project, we'll take public comment. We will ask that you raise your hand. We'll recognize folks. We'll have one of the handheld microphones brought to you. We would ask that you clearly state your name as well as your town. And we're going to ask that questions, we'll have a brief area for questions first, so the people who want to gain more information can do that. Then we'll proceed to shorter comments, 2 minutes or less. We understand people have jobs to get to and operations to get to. And so if you just want to make a 1 or 2 minute statement of concern or statement of support, we want to provide you that opportunity. And then we'll move into comments that are longer in length. We would ask that all comments stay on topic. Will allow a little bit of flexibility, but for instance, it's not this commission that would deal with any sort of condemnation of land or eminent domain issues. That would be a circuit court. And so statements on that topic aren't going to be particularly beneficial to the commission or to anybody else sitting here. And finally, we would ask that you try to limit any repetitive nature to the comments. We want to hear from you. We want to hear from as many of you as possible. And so if you agree with someone who's spoken before, Rather than say the exact same words, you can just let us know that, that that's how you feel as well. Add any comments that you want that, that add some flavor to that. But if we can eliminate the repetitive, that are going to allow more people an opportunity to be heard on this proceeding. We do ask that if you haven't done so yet, that you sign up on the sign-up sheet that are located at the top of the stairs on either side so that we have a record of who was here and who was interested in this project. With that, I'm going to pause and see if our general counsel, John Smith, or either of the commissioners has anything that I've missed. With that, we're going to look toward Brett Kennecke, who will be the lead spokesman here this afternoon for TransCanada. And I should note, before we do this, we do have a number of Public Utilities Commission staffers here that we should take an opportunity to recognize. We have Ms. Kara Semler right here. We have up at the top of the stairs Mr. Nathan Solem. We have back here Mr. Tim Binder. We have Ms. Stacy Splitstosher, I think somewhere. And we've got Mr. Bob Knadel up there at the top of the stairs. They would be happy to answer any questions you've got after this proceeding or throughout the process. So with that, Mr. Kennecke, please introduce the others with you this afternoon, and then you may begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and thank you, commissioners and staff. We appreciate your putting these meetings together for us. And thank you to those of you in the audience for your interest in the project as well. My name is Brett Kennecke. I'm a lawyer from Peer, and I represent TransCanada Keystone Pipeline in these proceedings before the Public Utilities Commission. With me this afternoon is Robert Jones, a vice president of TransCanada from Calgary, Alberta. John Phillips, next to him, is a pipeline engineer from Houston, Texas. And Jim White is on the TransCanada staff as well. Behind me are a number of subject matter experts relative to the topics that we think are of importance to you regarding the project. And as your questions come out, they'll try and do their best to answer them for you. Robert and John do have a short presentation for you, and then we'll look forward after that to engaging in a dialogue with you about the project. Thank you.
Hello, is this working? Can you hear me okay in the back? Thumbs up, I'd like to see that. Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Good afternoon, Commissioner Kolbeck, Commissioner Hansen, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Robert Jones, and I am the Vice President of the Keystone Pipelines, and we are here today to present to you some information on the proposed Keystone XL pipeline project. We're here to listen to your comments and answer your questions. Before I do that, I would like to take this time to acknowledge and recognize that many of you have concerns and about the construction and operation of a crude oil pipeline and that the potential effect it may have on your land. I also want to provide you with two commitments. The Keystone XL pipeline will be designed, constructed, and operated safely and in an environmentally friendly manner. Responsible manner. It is our commitment to treat landowners fairly and with respect. Let me tell you about TransCanada and the project. TransCanada is a leading North American energy infrastructure company. We are listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and we have over 50 years of experience. There are 4,000 employees. Approximately 1,500 of them are U.S. employees. Our headquarters are in Calgary, and we have U.S. headquarters in Houston. At TransCanada, we provide reliable supplies of energy across the continent. And we are proud of the millions of North Americans that depend on us every day to meet their energy needs. There are two logos on this slide that we're very proud of. Last September, TransCanada was named to the Dow Jones Sustainability World Index for the seventh year in a row. And for the third consecutive year, TransCanada has been recognized in 2009 as one of the most, the company ranks, this most sustainable corporation's ranking is for companies around the world based on their environmental record, and other key factors, including relationships with communities and stakeholders. This map gives you a geographic look at TransCanada's assets. We have over 40,000 miles of pipelines, either solely owned or in joint ventures, partnerships with others. We operate a growing fleet of power generation, wind, hydropower, nuclear, natural gas power generation. We supply electrical power throughout the United States and Canada. We are an energy infrastructure company with operations in Canada, United States, and Mexico. And we have ongoing relationships with over 40,000 landowners. TransCanada has been a part of South Dakota since the early 80s as an owner of the Northern Border Pipeline System. This system delivers natural gas to South Dakota and to the Midwest. We now own and operate this system, and the headquarters is in Omaha, and we have a field office in Brookings. Keystone's U.S. field operations will also be based in Omaha, and Keystone will have maintenance bases located strategically near the pipeline here in South Dakota. So why Keystone XL? The pipeline will connect the world's second largest oil reserve with the world's largest refining market. As you can see by this graph, countries in the Middle East and Venezuela, which are not friendly trading partners to the U.S., do hold the largest oil reserves. So it's easy to see why Canada is increasing in importance as a supplier to energy in the United States. Canada is the leading supplier of oil to the U.S. Canada supplies about 2.2 million barrels per day of the 20 million barrels per day consumed in the U.S. Canadian oil is growing. It's a growing source for the United States. Canada is the United States' largest trading partner, and Canada is a secure and reliable trading partner. Canadian oil does provide an opportunity to replace Middle Eastern, Venezuelan, and Mexican sources of oil that are declining, and declining U.S. production. This map depicts the geographic regions where the refineries are in the U.S. And as you can see, the refineries along the Gulf Coast represent 50% of the total U.S. refining capacity. Gulf Coast refineries are generally served by offshore sources. These supplies come from the Middle East, Venezuela, and Mexico. And they come via supertankers. These shipments are subject to weather disruptions like Hurricane Rita and Katrina, and, of course, other disruptions in production. These are the refineries that provide the gasoline and the diesel and the lube oil and the fertilizer and other products that each of us use every single day. And most of these products are transported to South Dakota via a pipeline from either the Gulf Coast refineries or from Cushing, Oklahoma area refineries. The Keystone XL pipeline project will have an initial capacity of about 700,000 barrels a day, and it'll be expandable to 900,000 barrels a day. It'll be operated as part of an integrated Keystone pipeline system. The maximum nominal capacity of the combined Keystone system is approximately 1.5 million barrels per day. The need for this pipeline is demonstrated by long-term commitments. U.S. refiners and marketers have executed binding contracts for 910,000 barrels a day for an average term of 18 years. Now, the estimated cost of the Keystone XL pipeline project is about $7 billion. And with the $5 billion Keystone pipeline, the total system overall capital value is approximately $12 billion. Now, timing. We will place the Keystone pipeline in service this year to serve the Wood River and Patoka, Illinois markets. In 2010, we'll complete what we call the Cushing extension to serve the Cushing, Oklahoma markets. Then, pending regulatory approvals, the Keystone XL construction will commence in 2011 and 2012 here in South Dakota. Here's a map showing the proposed route in South Dakota. It passes through portions of Harding, Butte, Perkins, Meade, Pennington, Hawken, Jones, Lyman, and Tripp counties. The capital cost of the Keystone XL pipeline project in South Dakota is $921 million. The pipeline is 313 miles in length and 36 inches in diameter. And you may have seen when you came in, there's an example of the pipe in the lobby. And you can see that later as you go out. There'll be 7 pump stations that'll keep oil flowing through the line, and there's 16 mainline block valves in addition to the 7 pump stations. Dennis Calhoun, Keystone's XL Manager of Land, is outside in the lobby for those of you interested in looking at detailed route maps. In fact, Dennis, you want to just wave? Pipelines are subjected to significant federal and state regulatory reviews. On the federal side, the Department of State will review the Keystone application for a presidential permit because we cross an international boundary. The Department of State is also the lead agency under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. There are a dozen other federal agencies that will review the project. There's the Army Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife, Department of Transportation, and the Bureau of Land Management. The South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, which Dossie described their scope, has siting authority to review this project. But in addition, the project is subject to review from other state agencies. They include the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources, or DENR, and the South Dakota State Historic Society. This is a map of more than the 1.3 million miles of existing oil and gas pipelines in the United States. We tend not to notice them because once they're in the ground, pipelines deliver nearly all of the gasoline and all of the natural gas and all of the diesel fuel used here in the U.S. and in South Dakota. The reason is because pipelines are by far the safest and most efficient mode of transportation. Interstate pipelines are regulated under federal jurisdiction. And the Department of Transportation has within the Department of Transportation, there's this agency called PHMSA, the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. They regulate pipeline safety. The PHMSA office for South Dakota is in Kansas City. In addition to helping South Dakota and the U.S. for its demand on oil, Keystone XL will deliver a number of local benefits to South Dakota. We estimate that between $20 and $30 million will be directly injected into the local economy. Pipeline and pump station contractors will purchase food, lodging, and construction consumables and other supplies as they work through 2011 and 2012. The Keystone Pipeline Project will be the largest private construction project in South Dakota. The workforce is estimated to be about 1,200 workers per year in 2011 and 2012. By far, though, the largest benefit to South Dakota will be property tax revenue. It'll be collected every year by the 9 counties and 13 school districts the pipeline traverses. We estimate that the first year property tax revenues in South Dakota to be $10.3 million. On top of that, state aid to education payments are estimated to be reduced by $5.2 million per year. There will be a significant reduction in tax burden benefiting all local property taxpayers. Another benefit, of course, is the reinforcement of the infrastructure, the local electrical co-ops. Route selection is a multi-step process. First, we identify the project objectives. For Keystone XL, these objectives were to transport Canadian oil to Gulf Coast refineries and construct the pipeline using the most direct route from Hardisty, Alberta, the starting point of the pipeline, to Steel City, where it connects back into the Keystone system. We tried to parallel existing infrastructure, like existing pipelines or power lines. Second, we identified the major control points. These control points were the entry point into the United States, the Fort Peck Reservoir, the Charles Russell National Wildlife Refuge, and Steel City. We had to connect to all these points. The project objective and major control points in hand, we defined the study area. We collected data, we consulted, we did desktop studies, we consulted agencies, we did public consultation, we did field reconnaissance surveys, and we collected a lot of data. We identified constraints and opportunities. We looked at environmental sensitive areas, local terrain, cultural features. We found in this area that there were no linear features like pipelines or power lines to parallel in that northwest-southeast direction. We also had to develop and assess alternative routes. Finally, additional input and refinements may occur as a result of further studies and further field work and further regulatory reviews. We developed a comprehensive construction, mitigation, and reclamation plan to minimize the environmental impacts based on industry best practices. There'll be a number of agencies, like the PUC, that will review and stipulate environmental protection measures, such as the Department of State and other federal agencies will look at environmental mitigation and those conditions to minimize other impacts. The PUC and South Dakota state agencies will also identify additional environmental mitigation conditions. Keystone will minimize the impact on the project, on the environment in South Dakota, through the use of these conditions and restoration measures. I'm now going to turn the mic over to John Phillips. He's our manager of construction and engineering, and he is going to tell you a little bit about construction and the easement requirements. John?
Thanks, Robert. To construct and operate the pipeline, Keystone will negotiate with landowners for a 50-foot wide permanent easement, as well as an additional 60 feet of temporary construction workspace. Landowners will be able to ranch and farm over the permanent easement after construction. Some areas, such as stream, road, and railroad crossings, as well as rough and hilly terrain, may require additional temporary workspace to safely complete construction. In addition, Keystone will obtain additional rights for access roads. Temporary workspace reverts back to the landowner after construction. In South Dakota, the project is divided into spreads, about 80 to 95 miles in length. This is a length that can be constructed in a single construction season. The pipeline is constructed like an assembly line, made up of different crews, each with a different task. Over 2 years, a total of about 2,500 construction workers will be spread over the length of the pipeline in the state. 500 to 600 construction personnel will be working per spread. Work progresses at about a mile to a mile and a half per day for each crew on the spread. After the right-of-way has been cleared and graded, the topsoil is stripped from the right-of-way, as shown on the right, and segregated away from the ditch spoils, which is shown on the left, in order to prevent mixing. Pipes delivered by train to rail sidings, unloaded, and trucked to pipe yards, which are adjacent to the pipeline right-of-way. Pipe in 80-foot lengths is loaded onto trucks at the pipe yard, delivered and strung along the right-of-way, and bent to conform to the contour of the ditch. The ditch is dug using a wheel ditching machine or a backhoe, and the ditch spoils are separated from the topsoil to prevent mixing. The pipe is welded together using an automatic, mechanized, or manual welding process. Every weld is inspected using an ultrasonic inspection tool or radiography to ensure that it meets quality requirements. The weld areas are sandblasted and coated. The pipe coating is inspected to ensure its integrity before it's lowered into the ditch. The pipe is lowered into the ditch in segments, and the segments are welded together at tie-in points. In areas of significant rock, the pipe is padded with select material, and the ditch is backfilled with the ditch spoils. After the contours have been restored to the original grade, the area is loosened to reduce compaction, the topsoil is spread back across the right-of-way, and the area is reseeding using specified seed mixes. Prior to digging, in compliance with state law, we contact the South Dakota One Call, who identifies the location of existing buried utilities. These existing utilities will often provide an on-site representative to inspect during excavation, as Keystone will when you call after construction. The pipe is fitted with test heads, filled with water, and hydrostatically tested to 125% of the operating pressure to comply with code requirements. In addition, the pipe is internally inspected with a device called a pig that is used to inspect the pipe from the inside for dents and ovality. Although construction will disturb your land, we will take great care to restore the land as close as possible to its pre-construction condition. We'll go to Robert Jones for the next slides. Robert?
Thanks, John. Keystone will meet or exceed all applicable codes and regulations. We talked previously about regulatory reviews that were associated with this pipeline project. There's a separate set of regulatory requirements and industry standards that apply to the design of pipelines. And they help ensure the pipeline safety and integrity for as long as we operate the pipeline. Industry standards reflect the knowledge gained from over 100 years of pipeline experience in North America. These regulations and standards are intended to ensure the protection of the public, the environment, and the prevention of pipeline failures. Keystone XL's design will reflect state-of-the-art safety features. For example, regulation requires 2.5 feet of cover. Keystone XL will construct with 4 feet depth of cover. This is to minimize the risk that a pipe could be accidentally struck by a third party after it is installed. And this is the leading cause, even though pipelines are failure, this is the leading cause, and when occurred, may cause, this is the leading cause of most failures on new pipelines. At TransCanada, we've designed a specification for high-strength steel pipe. It exceeds existing standards for the fabrication of large-diameter pipelines. TransCanada's specification for external pipe protective coating is fusion bond epoxy coating. This corrosion-preventing coating has virtually eliminated external corrosion as a source of failures in pipelines. In more than 29 years of TransCanada experience using fusion bond epoxy, we have never had a pipe failure due to corrosion. Cathodic protection is an additional protection if the coating is damaged after it is backfilled. We'll install markers at every road crossing, and we'll also bury warning tape when we cross a utility to act as additional warning if these utilities need to cross our pipeline. There are also isolation valves that are strategically located to protect the environment in the event of a release. Safety features associated with the construction of the pipeline include Keystone will go out and solicit bids from mills that have met TransCanada's quality standards. We'll supply direct quality oversight in the steel mills and in the pipe mills during fabrication of the pipe process. During construction, all welds are checked and qualified by a qualified X-ray or ultrasonic technician. Before the pipe is lowered into the trench, the coating is checked to ensure its integrity. After the pipe is lowered in and the ditch is backfilled, the entire pipe is filled with water, and then we pressurize it and test it to 125% of its maximum operating pressure. We also inspect the pipe internally using a caliper pig to ensure it met specifications. Now, land agents will be available during construction and will keep you in communication while all this activity is going on. The entire pipeline is monitored 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, by highly trained and qualified employees at our computerized control center. We have a backup center that provides redundant oversight capabilities, and they have dual communications, satellite communication systems, and we also have redundant multiple leak detection systems. The signals come to are transferred from the pump station and the pipeline system back to the control center approximately every 5 seconds. We have a pipeline integrity management program, which will maintain the quality of the pipe throughout its life. And Keystone will also have a damage prevention plan program that will participate in the South Dakota One Call. We also will do aerial surveillance, or line patrol. It will occur 26 times a year, and not to exceed 3 weeks. In the unlikely event of release, Keystone will implement its emergency response program to protect the safety of the public, to protect the environment, and minimize damage to your property and to company operations. The emergency response program will be submitted to PHMSA and the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Keystone's public awareness program will communicate our emergency response plan to stakeholders and community first responders. Keystone employees and contractors will be trained as first responders to address an emergency. Keystone will work with the community first responders, such as the local law enforcement and the fire department, so they're aware of our role and our capabilities, and that they are there to address public safety and secure the site. Keystone's commitment is to design, construct, and operate a safe pipeline, to build and operate in a social and environmentally responsible manner, to meet or exceed industry and government standards, consult with the stakeholders. Keystone will treat landowners with respect and fairness. We look forward to being a part of your community for generations and to be a good neighbor. Now, Keystone will continue to operate our project website. We have an email, a toll-free line to respond and receive communication inquiries from you. We want to foster ongoing consultation. You can find the toll-free number and the project website URL on the back of any Keystone XL brochure, which are available in the foyer behind this room. Again, Dennis Calhoun is here to talk to you and answer any of your landowner questions. I want to thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much to the applicant. With that, let's set aside 5 or 10 minutes for some questions to start with. Questions? Okay, hold on. We'll bring a mic right over.
I'm Constance Hoffman from Burke, and how are your stocks doing?
If you're asking us how is the financial strength or well-being of the company, I can tell you that TransCanada is doing quite well. We are a utility, and we've been successful with raising $2 billion in the first quarter when nobody else could raise any money at all. So our ability to raise money to fund this project is very secure. No question that we'll be able to do it. I think the most important thing is Standard & Poor's rates us as an A-grade credit company.
Okay. I just heard an ad. I don't really listen to television a lot, but are you spending a lot on advertising?
I would say part of the consultation process is that we have to communicate and make people aware of the project. So it's part of the requirement for consultation.
I also have a question about where you're getting the oil from, the tar sands of Canada. Maybe it's nice going through this state and it's clean and everything, but how is that taken care of on the other end?
You know, reasonable question. There's been a lot of misrepresentation, a lot of noise with regards to where the crude oil for the pipeline is coming from. The Keystone Pipeline can move all types of oil. I think everyone recognizes that the growing security of oil and the reason why Canada's production is growing is because of the oil sands. So what this is, and most people haven't been there, so they don't know what to expect. They just what they read in the papers. But what it is it's two ways to get the oil out of the ground. There's the mining project where they take sand that is coated in oil, and they remove the sand from the oil and they process it. This practice has been going on for 20 plus years, and they continue to improve how much gas and oil and water, sort of energy that is required to make a barrel of oil. The other method is what they call SAGD, and that's where you don't impact the surface at all. You inject steam into the ground, and then you pump out the oil because the steam loosens oil around the sand. So the oil sands is no doubt the largest growing source of oil, and we're the second largest reserve in the world. So that is the... Once the oil is out of the sand, it looks like any other oil. It has the same properties as oil as if it came from the Middle East or California or Cushing, Oklahoma.
Yeah, but how does the...
Ms. Hoffman, we'll certainly get to your questions, but we let you have three, so let's hear from some other folks and we'll come back.
I didn't hear that part. Sorry.
Well, I'm sorry. Ms. Hoffman did a very good job of asking her questions slowly and speaking loudly and clearly. We do have Sherry, who is a court reporter, and she struggles more with me talking fast than with most of other folks, but do exactly like Ms. Hoffman did, and we'll all be in great shape. So I hand over. Okay, go ahead. We've got right over here, and then we'll go over there.
Yes, hi. My name is Bruce Finns, and I'm from Dallas. You said one of the benefits was to enhance the infrastructure of local electric co-ops. How is that accomplished? And in particular, the electrical requirements of these pump stations are going to require new electric lines. Who's going to pay the cost of the infrastructure of building these electric lines?
There's no doubt the pump stations require, they use electric motors, and there's going to be demand for more electricity. So the local co-ops will provide that electricity for us, and we'll become the largest payer of electricity in those co-ops. And so that revenue will pay for the infrastructure that we're going to need to build the facilities.
But is there going to be any upfront payment to build that infrastructure?
It's really case-by-case basis. A lot of times the transformer or the substation is a solely owned Keystone facility, so it will be. A lot of times the reinforcement of the grid
is a benefit to all, so it's shared amongst all the payers. But because we're the largest payer, we're virtually paying for it over that duration. Not any different than anybody else.
My understanding for Pump Station 21 in particular, which is located in the very southeast corner of the pipeline in southeast Tripp County, is going to be serviced by a new transmission line that will run from the substation in Gregory to that pump, and it's going to service nothing but that pump. Who's going to bear the cost of building that line?
Again, because of the it's an overall transmission grid infrastructure, it's borne by everyone. It's just that we're the largest payer, so we'll obviously pay our fair share of the infrastructure.
Okay, I think we had a hand right there. Did you have? Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Brad Schramm from Winter. Of your existing pipelines that you currently operate, how many accidents per year would you say you have where you have leakage into the soil?
Probably because TransCanada is the Keystone Pipeline, the one that's been under construction right now, is the only liquid pipeline that we operate. The rest of them are natural gas pipelines. But we have in the past bought and sold other liquid pipelines. I think the way to look at it is much more of a general question with regards to all of liquid pipelines in North America. And, the number of leaks is really a function of a number of issues, such as the density of population, and so the third-party damage, or the age of the pipeline, and the technology. When it comes to new pipelines, we haven't had a leak caused by external corrosion in 29 years. But have we had an incident due to third-party damage? And, of course, that is true, we have. And we try to minimize that by doing aerial patrols and keeping the pipe 4 feet depth of cover. So by learning from all these different incidences, we build a safer pipeline.
Mr. Schramm asked specifically about any frequency. Do you have any information to respond to his question?
I think the answer, Dusty, Commissioner Hansen, is Johnson, I'm sorry. Is that we don't operate any liquid pipelines. So to say that the answer is zero. So I wanted to give him a solid answer, which is to look at the industry. And it is by far the safest mode of transporting hydrocarbon liquids.
Do you have any, with regard to your entire pipeline stock, including the natural gas pipelines, do you have any measurements of safety that might be instructive or helpful? And we can certainly move on to other questions, Mr. Jones's members.
We need a mic.
Oh, perfect.
Mira Kothari, TransCanada engineer. So specifically to address your question about frequency of leaks on TransCanada, I have the statistics for last year, and we had one incident of third-party damage last year. It was on an older pipeline in a more populated area, and so that's we typically don't have that many leaks on an annual basis on our natural gas system.
And Ms. Kothari, how many miles of pipeline are we talking about?
We have 40,000 miles of pipeline.
Okay. Thanks very much. Other questions?
Greg English, Tripp County. As a commissioner, I'm kind of concerned about the roads. They'll be beat up because of all bringing in the heavy stuff, the pipes and stuff like that. Are your contractors bonded, and will there be compensation to the counties for the the beating up of the roads?
Dennis, our land agent, will help answer that question. I think that thing
what we normally do, and one of our representatives will be working with each individual county. We do a transportation plan. We get your basic routing once you decide, or once we show you where our plans are to place things along there. We'll work with you as far as the culvert strengths, bridges, so on and so forth. And, yes, we will compensate back for those damages on those roads. But we'll work with you with for a transportation plan to make it less less onerous to everyone so we don't congest your roads and all of that. So it's quite a plan.
And, Commissioner, this dealt with the Keystone Pipeline east of the river, and so we do have some experience with it. But there is state law 49-41B-38 that does give the Public Utilities Commission the ability to require a bond for a construction bond that would cover damage to specifically county and township roads. And so we'll, as we consider that, we'll certainly take your comments into consideration.
Commissioner Johnson, if I could just add to that, if we were to look at that pipeline, in 2008 we had a bond for $3 million, and in 2009 we have a bond for $9 million, and we anticipate we'll have to have a bond for over the 2 years for this project as well.
Dan Porgy from Dallas. What is the formula that you're going to use to tax the land? You're going to send taxes back to us. What is your formula, and are the pump stations, what are they considered for a taxable entity?
So it'll be the state law for taxes, and I'm actually not the South Dakota tax state expert, if you can imagine, so let me just find somebody who might answer that for you.
I'm Bill Taylor from Sioux Falls, and I worked out the tax. I did the tax work for the estimating for the pipeline. The pump stations are included in the real property tax base in South Dakota, just like every other improvement to real estate is included. The way we worked out the tax numbers is the company knows the location of the pipeline, or the pump stations, and knows the approximate construction cost of each pump station. So we took county by county, where there's a pump station, added that into what the expected construction cost is in each county and worked out the taxes on that basis. And if you want to tell me, don't want to do it here, but when we're done, if you want to tell me where you live, what county and what school district you're in, I can give you an idea of the impact of the real estate taxes on you. I will tell you that in every county in South Dakota that the pipeline crosses, real property taxes will be reduced to all of the other landowners. If you want an example of that, Harding County, which just happens to have a school district that has the same boundaries as the county and has about 80 miles of the pipeline in it, real property taxes in Harding County will go down by half as a result of the construction of the pipeline. In other words, pipeline company will pay over half of the cost of education and government in Harding County.
My name's John Harder. I'm a landowner that the pipeline's crossing. One of the real big concerns is our ground source water. I think as far as South Dakota goes, that's probably our biggest and most important resource that we have. And the safety issue of protecting it, I think, is pretty important. And to my knowledge, you're applying for a permit to put in a lighter pipeline than what was originally sold to the public when you first come out here. We were told that it would be a half-inch thick pipeline clear across the pipeline, except for where you cross roads in high-stress areas. And now I'm being told that you're downsizing the size of the pipeline in the non-stress areas. And I just think that was pretty unresponsible as far as you guys putting in the pipeline, and you said you're putting in a safe pipeline. I just like you to address to the public, how do you think putting in a lighter pipeline when you don't have probably a 40-year study on how long that lighter pipeline is going to last compared to the heavier pipeline?
I like to address a lot of misinformation out there with regards to this pipeline wall thickness concerns and the belief that we've changed what we first came out with. We never changed The pipeline that we originally designed to be built in this has never changed. It's exactly the same. There's been no variation in what we proposed initially. Now, to discuss the pipeline safety aspect, we have a pipeline engineer here that will give you exactly a detailed explanation about that. This is code for Mike.
Thanks. Hi again. I'm Mira Kothari, TransCanada Engineering. So just a little bit of background on the special permit. Under the Pipeline Safety Act, operators are allowed to apply for variances to the current standards for natural gas pipelines due to the volume of applications on this particular special permit. The 0.8 design factor is now a federal standard. For liquid pipelines, the avenue still continues to be an evaluation of a case-by-case basis on the design, the proposed design, construction, and operation. The 0.8 design has actually been around for about 30 years in Canada on oil and gas pipelines, and recently, over the last 5 years, has been reintroduced into the United States on pipelines, primarily due to the advance in materials and construction technologies and integrity management practices. An integrity management law was passed in 2002 requiring operators to have much more comprehensive integrity management plans in order to maintain the safety of the pipelines. Now, when we talk about wall thickness, pipeline safety isn't solely a function of wall thickness. There are a number of aspects that go into coming up with how safe is a pipeline. We look at things like the steel quality, the strength of the steel, if the operator has a quality management system in place, what we do as far as inspection, when we purchase components, when we get those components fabricated, and inspection out on the right-of-way during construction. So there's a number of aspects that kind of go into determining whether a pipeline is safe or not, and wall thickness is simply one factor in that all-encompassing evaluation of design. So the wall thickness for this line is 0.463 inches. The half-inch thick wall, as you mentioned, sir, would be going in at higher stress areas from a constructability standpoint, such as road bore crossings or drills for river crossings. I'll give that back to Robert to answer that, but I don't believe that is the case.
Yes, sir, there's never been a change in the design of the pipeline from the initial proposal. So there's no question that for road crossings and borings, we have to use half-inch wall.
It is a few minutes before 1, and so I just want to pause. Let's hold off on questions, and let's see if anybody has to get back to work, wants to make brief comments of concern, support, opposition, whatever. So let's hold the questions and go to anybody who's got to go. Okay, with that, let's go ahead and go in and go ahead.
Bob Beck, Dallas, South Dakota. Are you guys trying to be able to use a greater percentage of pressure in your line over what we have for standards in the United States as of right now? On a percentage basis for max pressure?
You have to operate the pipeline at a design factor. The code allows you to have a design factor in natural gas that Mira just said. We're also applying for that same standard. So that's within the code standards of that's managed by PHMSA.
Is the code standards the same on oil versus gas lines?
It is the same code, yes, that's correct. Just that picture I showed earlier, it's the same code. And it does allow for this range.
My name is Don Sable. I've got land that's just south of Winter, and my question is, we lease out a quarter section of land, and do the cattle evidently have to be out of there when you folks come through? How do you handle that as far as like a contract with the cattle that are like on a 3-year contract now for a pasture. I just wondered if I have to move them out of there, and will this guy have to find other land?
Don, it's a good question. I'm just going to have Dennis, our land manager, give you the answer to that.
What we do on that is we work an individual plan with each individual owner on those particular situations.
Dennis, what have you typically seen?
Well, I've been in the cattle business for 42 years myself down in Missouri, and it's not a whole lot different than what you have here. And I kind of understand the needs that your cattle are going to have. And I normally come out on those situations, and I'll sit down with you, and we'll make out some type of a workable situation.
Before taking the next question, I want to go back, and Mr. Jones, I don't think there was anything wrong with your answer. I just think maybe it was a little incomplete to this gentleman's question. Could you go into a little more detail about the 0.72 standard that PHMSA has versus the 0.8 that this application calls for?
Certainly. The code, Commissioner Johnson, allows us to have a range. It is absolutely the standard in gas now to go with 0.8. That's just a recent change in the code. We're requesting PHMSA to acknowledge the 0.8 design factor as opposed to the 0.72 design factor. If you look at the last case, in order for us to get that 0.8 design factor, we had to increase our safety protections in 50 other areas. And so the conclusion by the Department of Transportation is that the pipeline we were specifying with the 0.8 design factor was safer than if we didn't use any changes to the existing standard at all. So it was a combination of things. Wall thickness is really a combination of a number of things. And a lot of people think that if you use 0.72, you get thicker wall pipe. But because you can use different strength of steel, you can actually get thinner wall pipe with 0.72 design factor.
I guess my question was more about the actual percentage of pressure you guys are going to be putting onto the pipe. From what I've understood, that you guys are wanting to increase that by a small amount of like 4 to 6% over what our standards are as of right now.
No, there's no difference in the operating pressure. The code is very clear on that. We have to test 125%, and so we're not going to change the code with regards to that.
What percent of pressure are you going to run in this line to max pressure?
There's specific numbers. I just don't want to have an error, so I'll have my engineer answer.
Sorry, so I think from what I understand your question is, so when we talk about 0.72 and 0.8, we're actually talking about the hoop stress of the pipeline, not so much the pressure of the pipeline. So the pressure in the line is 1440 PSI, and that's the max pressure. That's not going to change. What does change when we go from 0.72 to 0.8 is the maximum allowable operating stress on the line, and so that percentage is going to change from 0.72 to 0.8, so that's the factor or the percentage in change, but it doesn't actually change the pressure in the pipeline. It just allows us to operate at a higher stress level with specific increase in safety in 50 other areas.
Mr. Jones, this is Commissioner Kobach. Could you maybe, just back to that gentleman's question, could you tell what is the difference between 0.8 and 0.72? Is it correlate to 0.08 of an inch, or does it correlate to a quarter of an inch or half inch, or what is the difference, do you know?
Commissioner Kobach, and I'll have Mira also follow up with my question. Because you can consider so many factors when specifying out a pipe specification, which, by the way, ours exceeds all standards, to turn around and say, well, what is the difference? It depends on a whole bunch of assumptions. So we'd have to go back and say, assuming all the assumptions are the same and the only variable you changed was the 0.72 or 0.8 design factor, then what is the resulting wall thickness? I assume that's the kind of question you're looking for, is it?
And I guess I'm just kind of going back to the first original pipeline, and this one too. But the I was under the understanding that 0.8 to 0.72 on the wall thickness of the pipe is 8/1000ths of an inch.
Yeah. So
all things kept equal.
Yes.
Yeah, all right.
It is. Okay.
Other questions? Mike, great.
Yes. It's 0.05 inches.
Yeah. My name is Diane Fisher, and I'm from Winter, South Dakota. And I'm asking, who has the cleanup fund? Does South Dakota have a cleanup fund, or does TransCanada? And who's is used first?
So by federal and state laws, the pipeline operator, which is TransCanada, is responsible to clean up any incident or any release. So there is no ambiguity here. It is TransCanada.
Okay, we've got T.J. Knutson, and we'll go ahead and take this question, and then we'll go back up here and try to follow Mike.
So the question was, does it the same Oklahoma? So the only thing I want to caveat, because I'm not aware of the laws in Oklahoma with regards to intrastate, in other words, that's pipelines that don't cross the state line, but for interstate pipelines, which are regulated by PHMSA, the component is responsible for the cleanup.
And to add, and the other commissioners, or Mr. Smith will correct me if I'm wrong, there is a fund that probably serves a similar purpose within South Dakota's Department of Environment and Natural Resources. I think it's called the Substance Release Fund. And I think it wouldn't be surprising to imagine that there may be some information entered on that fund in the proceeding, in the formal proceeding on this docket.
I interpreted your question a little bit different, but we do at the Public Utilities Commission have a pipeline safety organization inside our organization. Nathan Solom and Stacy Flitstoser are actually part of that. So if it's an intrastate pipeline, in other words, it starts and ends in the state, we also have a department for that. So only natural gas pipelines. And I guess that's what I kind of interpreted your question as, is that Oklahoma had a department, South Dakota does too, but it only applies to natural gas. Interesting.
We have Mike up there, Ms. Flitstosher. Okay, go ahead.
Doug Weekin, Winter, South Dakota. I'm curious to know about the abrasiveness of tar sand oils and the effect on pipelines, and also the velocity of the flow through the pipe, at what that would be if you're pushing 1,440 pounds per square inch, 9 million gallons a day is like 400 gallons a second. So if you've got 5-second delays between your monitoring, you could dump 2,000 gallons out in a matter of a second, or in 5 seconds, rather. And then this is another question perhaps the PUC can answer. You're starting off with the value of this pipeline. How is it depreciated? So after X number of years, when do we get what happens to the value of the pipeline? What happens to the pipeline when its lifetime is expired? And who's responsible for cleaning it up or taking care of it? And then the other thing that the PUC might be interested in doing is requiring wind generation along the pipeline to supplement the power demands. Otherwise, I suspect all we're going to be getting from our REAs are rate increases for peak demand.
Commissioner, there were a number of questions there. I'll try and see if I can walk through each of your questions. The first one I'd like to answer is on oil sands abrasion. The oil sands, before it comes into the pipeline, has to meet a specification. This is the same specification that all oil pipelines in North America has to meet. There is no sand in oil sands production. It is removed at the site. And so the oil that we're moving is the same oil that you would get from Venezuela or Mexico or in the Middle East or here in the United States. So there's no abrasion issue with regards to oil sands production. The other one was with regards to velocity. The pipeline is designed to move in turbulent flow, The actual rate or velocity, I'll have to just get for you, and I'll ask somebody else to answer that question. And then the last question with regards to abandonment, and that's what are we going to do with the pipeline once we're done using it? So the answer to that question is that this pipeline, of course, is designed to last well over 100 years. And with the second largest reserves connected to the largest market, we anticipate that it will be used for generations. Also, once it's finished this usefulness, pipelines can be converted to do other services. So, for example, in the first pipeline, we converted a gas line into oil service. So pipelines tend to be recycled, I should say, with regards to their usefulness. Ultimately, if the life of the pipeline is no longer required, then we'll comply with whatever the laws are at that time. Now, velocity. Our engineers are quickly trying to calculate it.
We'll take another question here and come back.
A lot of people ask, how long does it take a barrel of oil to go from Alberta to market? And it's somewhere between 20 or 30 days. So that might give you an idea about how fast it moves. I've always used the analogy, it's a jogging pace. If you could actually jog for 20 straight days, you'd be able to go for Alberta well into the market.
Robert? It's about 3 miles per hour is the velocity.
Yeah, that's not a very fast jog, Mr. Jones. You may need to get out a little more. Okay, we've got right here. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm Emily Boyd. I'm from Rosebud. I had some questions regarding our water lines. I read in one of these, I can't find it now, that there was a saying that the line will run parallel to existing electrical buried lines or water lines. Is there at any point, whether it's in Joes County all the way down to Tripp County, because we have a water line coming from Joes County as well as the Tripp County Waters User District, is there any point in which the pipeline will cross it? And if so, are there any extra safety precautions, any liners, you know, concrete casings, anything extra that's being taken into consideration?
Great question. When I was talking about parallel infrastructure, we typically look at steel pipelines like natural gas or crude oil pipelines. That being said, on your other questions on crossing water lines, I'll get John to answer that question.
Yes, we've been working with some of the rural water systems, getting their maps, having some discussions. There will be some line crossings of rural water systems, okay? And what we'll do is we're going to make arrangements to reimburse those water systems to lower their pipe in the area where we'll be doing our construction. It'll be a reimbursable situation that gets the water pipe down out of the way, and we can come through with construction with plenty of separation to where there aren't any issues during construction. We'll send our survey personnel out when the utilities or when the water systems do this work. We'll do this. We'll survey the location of where the line is, check the depth of cover, and so we'll know where that is during construction to make sure we don't have a conflict or any kind of an issue.
In the case of a leak, there wouldn't be any extra safety liners, any other casings that would be involved in those areas? Because, I mean, the line crossing isn't a large area that would require that, but in the case of a leak, I mean, our pipes aren't going to be able to withstand a leak like yours would have the special liners and meet all the codes. I mean, ours aren't designed to carry oil. So, I mean, I don't know how the specifics are, but is there any extra that we can sit down and talk about? I mean, has it already been, are the plans already in place?
There's a lot of misrepresentation with regards to the impact of water lines when crossed by an oil pipeline. If in the event that there was a leak at a water crossing, and by the way, we typically cross them perpendicular. We don't normally parallel water lines. The crude oil properties aren't going to all of a sudden get right into the line and cause damage. There's been a lot of false interpretation with regards to that, and a lot of statements just aren't true. Now, that being said, we have an expert with regards to that who can help answer that as well or supplement my question response.
My name is Heidi Tilquist. We did actually look quite a bit at permeation of crude oil and whether it could get into a PVC or a ductile iron water main. There's actually been quite a bit of research done by the American Water Works Research Foundation, so a lot of the main water users. What they found is that it takes extremely high concentrations of solvents such as toluene or benzene to actually start affecting the structure of the PVC to allow the material to start getting into the pipe. The thing is when you get into gasoline or specifically into crude oil, the content of the benzene and the toluene is so low that talking to the researchers that did this, they said there's no way for that solvent to even begin to get into the pipe. So there is that the crude oil cannot penetrate PVC pipe nor the ductile iron.
Let's pause for just a minute. We're off the record. Ms. Willer, are you okay? Okay, good. All right, we're back on the record. Go ahead.
Doris Miner, Dallas, South Dakota. I have three questions. Can you spell a cell space in that easement to another for other pipelines? Can there be more than one pipeline in that position? And could it be sold to somebody else? Mineral rights. Does the farmer rancher get to retain his mineral rights? And Mr. Taylor, the tax man, did he also give the figures as the depreciation sets in and what? Thank you.
Thank you. So the first two questions I'd like to ask Dennis to answer, and then I'll get Bill to answer the third one.
The first question on multiple pipes. The easement document has the letter S behind pipelines, and if you don't like that, you can negotiate that with my land agents. They'll have the authority to remove that. The second question, would somebody repeat that second question? It was about mineral rights, right?
Mineral rights. Do they lose their mineral rights?
No. The easement has no bearing to your mineral rights, and that is also stated in the easement document that the landowner will retain all mineral rights.
There was a question about the ability of the applicant to sell some of that easement usage to a third party. Mr. Calhoun?
No. The easement, it will be for 50 feet, and the easement, a subsurface easement, will belong to TransCanada Keystone Pipeline. They'll hold that right.
Tax depreciation.
Who am I talking to? There we are. When we worked out the tax estimates, we did it for the first year of operation based on construction costs. The South Dakota Code says that the Department of Revenue will determine the assessed valuation of the pipeline on an annual basis going forward. And it takes into account the classical three appraisal factors, the market value, the income produced, and the cost. What will happen down the road, I don't know the answer to. As the value of money changes, the value of the pipeline will increase. As the pipeline ages, the pipeline will decrease. The value of the pipeline will decrease. So, theoretically, there will be a reduction in the tax benefit that comes to South Dakota from the pipeline. Whether or not that actually happens, I don't know the answer to. We don't have any examples to look at. We do have, in South Dakota, we have refined products pipelines that were built in the late 40s in the eastern part of the state. The assessed valuation for those pipelines today is based on the market value of the pipeline, what it would cost if the Magellan Company wanted to sell that pipeline to somebody else. And compared to the original construction cost, the market value for assessed valuation of those pipelines has changed dramatically with the 50-year change in money, the value of money. So it's really very difficult to predict. We have to assume that at least for the first several years, the construction cost of the pipeline, almost $1 billion in South Dakota, is going to be the baseline that taxes will be calculated from.
Well, We'll certainly continue to take other questions, but because we've been at questions for more than a half an hour, we'll now open it up as well to comments. So we'll just take the shorter comments and questions at this point. Anybody who's got them? Yes.
Yeah, my name is John Whiting, RST Water Resources, Rosebud Sioux Tribe. We constructed a water line through the Cedar Butte area. It had hydrocarbon contamination from the underground storage tanks. When we consulted with the manufacturer of the PVC pipe, they said it wouldn't hurt the PVC pipe, but it'll hurt the gaskets, the hook, you know, to seal the water when you join the pipe. Is there a provision put in the plan to protect that aspect of water lines?
Just give us a minute.
There is the potential, if again, as you're saying, the gaskets that where the PVC pipes are joined, there's a rubberized gasket. There's some gaskets that are more resistant than others. We haven't discussed, I guess, the details of that. But if there was a crossing, my guess would be that we'd be working with the water users to look at either using the more resistant gaskets. And if that is insufficient to keep the hydrocarbon, should a spill occur, then we'll be looking at other methods to make sure that those water lines could not be contaminated.
John, did you want to add some of the discussions you've had with some of the rural water boards?
Yes. Some of the things we've talked about with some of the rural water systems and with the question that you asked, ma'am, earlier, as part of this reimbursement relocation, if the we talked about allowing the rural water systems to put casings in, for a couple of different reasons. One, in the future, if let's say you want to change that water line out, make it bigger or something like that, then you can do that without having to dig over the top of the pipe. So it's a risk mitigation issue that benefits both of us. If you have plans for a future water line through that area, we'll entertain or we'll certainly discuss about reimbursing to have another casing put through there for a future water line that crosses. That way, you're working through a piece of casing that's pre-installed, and you're not having to dig over the top of the pipe. It benefits both of us. It mitigates risk. And so we have been having some discussions about that with some of the different rural water systems that we've talked to.
Candy Urquhart, and talking about the water lines, I actually have a question related to that. I have a small farm that's within a mile of the proposed pipeline, and my question is not in with a water line. In southern Tripp County, we have very high water table, and in that sandy country and shallow wells, we might have a 30 or 40 or 50 foot well. And my concern is if you have a leak, you have a problem, and the water table is contaminated within a certain area, what's your plan for recovery or compensation? What are we going to do about our high water tables for those of us who operate with wells and we're not otherwise connected to the pipeline?
Yeah, I'll get Heidi to answer that.
That's a good question. First of all, I think one of the main things that Keystone really wants to emphasize is that nobody wants a spill. It's not in anybody's interest. So prevention is going to be by far the key to preventing any sort of contamination of your water. So whether it's through routing or through the materials that they're using or through a number of the design factors, the construction, the burying the pipeline 4 feet underground, those are all ways we're trying to mitigate an accident from occurring. The frequency of a pipeline spill in a specific area is very low. We're talking about an estimate roughly, and again, this would be very conservative, so we don't expect it to be this great, but no more than one spill in every 7,400 years for a given mile pipe. So pipeline spills are fairly infrequent. But if it occurred, There's a number of things that occur. First of all, we've got a leak detection system. John can talk about that, but there we've got not only is the pipeline remotely monitored all the time, but if a leak is detected, they will send out emergency response crews to immediately start containing and cleaning up the spill. Those are key to trying to limit the extent of the contamination. But you're right. In Tripp County, you've got highly permeable soils. You've got shallow groundwater table, so there is a chance that that oil could reach the groundwater. So this is where I kind of get it. This is the my fun stuff. If oil actually gets to the groundwater, the oil tends to stay in one place. The oil adheres to the sand particles, so the oil is usually in one place. Over time, what can happen is dissolved constituents within the oil. When the things we're going to be concerned about are the benzenes, the ethylbenzenes, the toluenes, and the xylenes, what we call BTECs. They are water-soluble compounds within the oil. They can actually start dissolving out of the oil. They get into the groundwater, and they can start moving. They move in the direction of the groundwater. What they've found is that unlike persistent chemicals like PCE and TCE and some of the fertilizers, petroleum hydrocarbons undergo what's called natural attenuation. Natural attenuation is basically there's microbes that live in the soil, and they begin to basically eat the hydrocarbons. Now, if there was four studies that were done nationwide, they looked over at 600 spills looking at BTEX contamination and how far, if it spills, how far is this actually going to migrate? They found that the BTEX contamination in over 90% of the cases was limited to several hundred feet from the actual source. So it's not like if we spill something, you're well a mile away or, the entire Ogallala Aquifer or something is going to be contaminated. It's a very small area that tends to be contaminated. That said, let's say your well happens to be in the area that is contaminated. There's water quality standards that we're going to have to meet. We're going to be meeting with the South Dakota DENR. There's going to be state and federal agencies that are going to be involved looking at this. They're going to make sure that the water quality standards are met. There's certain criteria for doing this. If there is a need to provide an alternative water source, Keystone is responsible for providing you an alternative water source.
Larry Wagner, Clome. I've got two quick questions. What is the temperature of the oil going to be coming through the pipeline, and how much electricity will each pump station consume, and how big a horsepower motors or whatever?
Kara, could we have the... How dare you stand still for a second?
That was 3 miles an hour. just a couple background items on the temperature of the oil. When the oil initiates at Hardisty in the pipeline, TransCanada does not heat the oil. The oil gains temperature by moving along the pipeline due to friction through the pumps. Currently, we estimate the temperature of the oil inside the pipeline to be between 89F and 120F. The temperature varies during the time of the year. It varies based on viscosity, and it also varies based on the flow rate in the pipeline. Currently, we are conducting additional thermal studies similar to those that were conducted for the base pipeline for Keystone to determine additional thermal modeling and thermal effects of the temperature of the oil in the line. Does that answer your question? We don't have the consumption aid readily on hand yet. Oh, you do? Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Neil Myers, and I'm the Vice President of the Keystone XL Pipeline Project. And to answer your question, Robert said when he was doing his presentation, the plan is to put the pipeline in with a capacity of 700,000 barrels, and it's expandable to 900. At 700,000, we need 3 6,500 horsepower pumps at each station in order to move that volume, and that consumes about 17 megawatts of electricity. And fully expanded, we would have 5 pumps at the same size at that station, and it would consume about 25 megawatts worth of electricity. And that's sort of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Although we do modulate and turn the line on and off, it's on most of the time. That's per station, sir.
Sorry, I just wanted to add some additional information to the remarks around the oil temperature. So the analysis from the Keystone study showed that there were no significant effects to crops. Our expectation from the similar study that we're conducting for the Xcel pipeline is that, again, there would be no significant impact to crops based on the temperature of the pipeline. However, as always, if there are effects or documented damage for crops, Keystone will compensate.
That's one of the benefits of having the pipe, cover with 4 feet above it.
Wayne Meyer, Winner. Back to this taxation. You say $10 million for the state of South Dakota. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, when do these payments start?
Yeah, the $10 million is the first-year assessment in South Dakota. So it would start, and this pipeline would be 2013. Not at the full value, right? So that the full value that you came up with was based at that much. There will be a pre-tax number once there's some assets already in the pipeline. But where do we get the $10 million? It was based on the $931 million construction estimate, and it would be for 2013. But it's using today's dollars, so in today's formula. So it's kind of a complicated answer.
Okay, my name is Kevin Peters, work for a utility company here. My question right now is, during the construction process on all the buried utility lines, do you just try to cross those? Do we have to remove them, get them lower? I guess where you got a 50-foot easement, I was just kind of curious how you handled all these crossings, because we'll have quite a few of those in the county.
One of my agents will be dealing, we have a person we call a permit specialist, and we do a foreign utility crossing agreement with each and every individual utility that we cross, whether it be water lines, phone lines, power, whatever. So, and we even do this on the aerial power lines and stuff. Sometimes the power lines are too low, and they have to raise them. So every utility crossing that we do, we have an agreement with that particular company. We spell out every agreement, as John alluded to earlier. And your input, I mean, it's a two-way deal. We make a contract there.
Okay, let's take another question, and then we'll take a short break so our court reporter can rest those hands and we can let nature call. Another question? Who's got the mic? Go ahead, sir.
Bob Beck at Dallas again. I was wondering, how much noise are these pump stations going to give off? There's about 5 families that live within a mile or less of the pump station 21 down in south eastern part of Tripp County.
John. We'll need the mic.
John Schmidt, work for the team on the environmental side. I've been told these pumps are likened to interstate noise at, I think, half mile, 100 yards or so. They're electric-driven pumps, so they're quieter than, say, a gasoline or diesel-powered.
I live 70 miles from an interstate. That really don't tell me nothing. I mean, you got a decibel that they're going to give off? And is there
I don't have any measurements from these particular pumps now. Do you have any information, Neil? Or?
Is there a certain standard that you guys have to stay below for noise?
No.
Yeah, that's the short answer to am I on?
No.
Okay. The short answer to that is no. There is no federal regulation in the United States that covers the noise levels from the pump stations.
That still don't really tell me how noisy they are.
Right.
Are they going to affect wildlife?
So
are they going to affect the way I live? Because I don't hear nothing in the morning when I get up.
Right. So, and I'll try to answer your question. And this is a very difficult thing to talk about in specifics because the noise that you'll experience will be different than the noise that you will experience in you because it depends on so many factors, the topology of the land and vegetation and other noise sources. You know, if you live in, there's nothing where you are currently, we might be the only noise source, but other people will live in places where there are other. And so I don't want to seem evasive. I'm not trying to be evasive, but I just don't want you to get the idea that I give you a simple response to the answer. I think what we were trying to use in the example is we think that it's about the same level of noise as if you were standing 100 yards from a highway and a car was going by at 40 miles an hour. So I don't know if that's something you can relate to or not. It's a very difficult thing to say here. I think the noise that it gives off is closest to living to a highway, like the sort of kind of noise that you hear. It's sort of that, you know, background buzz almost that you hear from a highway. And that's sometimes why we use that analogy. The pumps themselves are rated at 85 decibels at 1 meter, which is pretty close to a yard. So if that means anything to you, that would mean that we would require our workers to wear hearing protection to actually work on the pumps if they were running. Because our spec is if it's 80 dB or higher, you have to wear hearing protection, and these are 85 at 1 meter. So that's another number that we can work. And then I think the commitment that we'll make is that we want to work with landowners, and if there's a problem, there are things we can do. We can install blankets. We can install lagging on the pipe. It's actually the oil moving through the pipe creates some of the noise. It's not, and the oil moving through the pump is actually noisier than the motor is, for example. Then we can lag that. So there are things that we could do to try to make that as not as much of an issue for you, but they do create noise, yeah, that's true.
Will these pumps be in a building, or will they be outside?
They will be outside. In fact, there is a building on site. There's a prefab building that holds the electrical controls, and that's all.
Is there any of these pump stations in the United States that are in operation that we could go and listen to one?
All over the place.
Yeah, for sure. Nick, you saw that map that showed all those pipelines. So there is.
But
there
them are for natural gas, sir.
No, those were oil and gas pipelines, and there's refined product pumps throughout this state as well. You'd have to get a hold of either Pipeline or Magellan would be in this state to
at
go
this
by one.
Size?
This size, there are very, very few pumps that you would be able to go and have a sound of. But that being said, the technology is the same. And I think, like Neil said, the 85 dB. I think the commitment that Neil made is that we're going to have to work with different landowners because the noise impact will change depending on where you live and how far you are from the pump station.
We've had a question, you know, asking specifically about decibels. I know you don't have the answer right now, but since we do have a 10-minute break we're going to be taking, perhaps, Mr. Jones, you can huddle with your team and see if you've got any information on hand with that you can be more specific to respond to the question.
But, as I said, Commissioner, the pumps are rated at 85 dB at a meter. We cannot tell you what the noise level will be 500 yards from a particular pump station or to a particular dwelling. We would have to actually do a noise study.
TransCanada has not done any noise studies showing how that noise would dissipate?
No, we have not.
Well, so when we look at RLRC, it's all site-specific. So, yeah, we do lots of studies. We have to go out there after it's installed and do the measurements and then figure out what we would do to be able to mitigate the noise issue. It's really a mitigation issue.
And it's partly a pre-construction issue, too. So, for example, in South Dakota, We received some comments from some landowners near Pump Station 19, and we looked into that situation, and they were right. And so we're working on moving Pump Station 19 to a different location because that's the best way to mitigate that noise is to take it away from the dwelling. So it's not always a post if we can. Now, of course, once we start, moving them becomes very, very difficult, but we try to do that early.
We've been at it for 100 minutes. We will come back to the noise question and follow up with some more specificity, and I know we've got other questions to come. So we'll it's now 1:40, and we'll be back at 1:50 or as soon thereafter as we can.
Hello.
Testing.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go ahead and get started back up. We've got maybe a follow-up question or two on noise, but before we do that, we're going to give Mr. Kennecke, Mr. Jones an opportunity to clean a couple things up.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. On noise, one thing that I'd like to say is I've been involved in a number of these siting dockets, both for pipelines and for other projects as well, and as a part of every one of those, the Commission has taken evidence on noise and entered an order as to what the noise could be. My recollection is that on the last Keystone Pipeline hearing, the standard was 55 decibels at 100 feet from the nearest receptor. That's just going off my memory. But what I guess the point that I want to make is that I believe and I know that the Commission is going to enter some kind of an order on that after the evidence has been received at hearings later on. And I expect them to give a great deal of attention to that. We look forward to having that dialogue with you. But correct me, Mr. Smith, do you recall, is it 55 decibels 100 feet from the nearest receptor? Was that the last order?
You're on.
Yes, that's my recollection.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Yep. We also want to clarify on the easement. There was a question about, I think the question was about dividing the easement for the pipeline and perhaps selling a portion of the easement to somebody else. That is not what the TransCanada would do, but we do want to make clear that it's possible that the easement, the pipeline itself, will be sold to another entity. If that was the case, any entity which bought it would assume all of the conditions which any federal agency put on it or any state agency, including the PUC. So whatever's decided through the course of these hearings would be the conditions which would apply to the operation ongoing as to anybody who bought it. And finally, I will let Mira talk just briefly, if she might, commissioners, about some of the pressures of the pipeline and operations. And I believe that we've got a lapel microphone back here, so there's no more sprinting by the staff.
Thanks, Brett. Hello? Okay. So while we addressed earlier one of the questions regarding the pressure in the line, and we talked about the operating pressure generally being 1440 PSI, there are select locations downstream of pump stations due to the elevation profile in the line and the hydraulic head of the crude oil that would experience a potentially higher pressure. Those select locations, while the pump units would discharge at 1440 PSI, could be subject to pressure as high as 1600 PSI. The length downstream of the seven pump stations here in South Dakota, that length varies between less than 0.1 miles up to about 4 miles downstream of those stations. So while we talk about the pipeline generally operating at 1440 PSI, due to elevation and hydraulic head, there are some that are subject to the 1600 PSI. Now, these particular locations will not be subject to the 0.8 design factor. We would use the 0.72 design factor pipe wall thickness, and that thickness is 0.573 inches.
Okay, thanks very much. And we'll go here, and then we'll go here, and then... Okay, then we can go there. Go ahead.
Yes, Bruce Vinson from Dallas. If this is the comment portion, I have a comment to make regarding the cost of the infrastructure of building the electrical lines to power the pump stations. As I understood the answer to my earlier question, there's not going to be any upfront cost paid by TransCanada to build these electric lines. Instead, they'll pay their fair share. If I understood 25 megawatts, my understanding is that's equivalent right now to what Rosebud Co-op, generally, the entire system is, which means, let's assume it is 25 megawatts, they're going to pay half. That means all the rest of us co-op members are going to pay half. That line is about 20 miles in length, all but the last approximate 3 miles of which are in Gregory County. Gregory County isn't going to get one penny of tax revenue from this oil pipeline, and yet all of those of us who don't live in Tripp County and are part of the Rosebud Co-op are going to be paying half of the cost of the infrastructure to service this pump station. I think that's just wrong. I think they ought to be building it, and my understanding is it could be anywhere from $200,000 to $250,000 a mile, $4 to $5 million upfront costs to build this line that's going to service that pump station and that pump station only. That's just not a cost that ought to be borne by the rest of the co-op members.
Sir, have you raised those issues with the cooperative, the electric provider?
Yes, met with them. We met with them this morning and asked about that, and the answer was, well, we don't know who's going to pay the upfront cost. But after hearing the answer to my question earlier, now we do know. It's going to be all the co-op members.
We'd like to respond to that. So I know it was a comment, but if you don't mind, we'd like to clarify, because I think there is a misunderstanding on how that calculation works and with regards to the transmission line.
So I can't speak very specifically to your particular situation, but I think I can help clarify what's going on. We are in the process of working with the utilities at all 41 pump stations at all 41 pump stations right across the whole length of the system for the supply of electrical power. There are three ways that electrical power is supplied, and it's up to the utility. The utility may say to us, here's where you can connect to us. You build the facilities at your cost, and here's where you connect. It's your problem, and that's fine. We're glad to do that. Sometimes the utilities say, give me a big bucket of money, and I will build it for you, and then I will charge you a rate that's similar to what everyone else pays for the actual power, and we're happy to do that too. And sometimes the utilities say, I want to build this for you. I don't want a big bucket of money first. What I want you to do is pay a different rate for a period of time, which we negotiate in a contract, so that we repay back to the utility the cost of the infrastructure. They tell us what those costs are, and it's up to the utility to manage that. So they figure that out and charge, what am I going to charge TransCanada, and what is that impact on the other ratepayers in the utility? It's not up to TransCanada, and it's up to the utility to set the type of deal that they want. It's not up to us. So we are sort of like you, a little bit of a victim, because the utility says, here's the way the deal's going to be. We negotiate the best we can, and then that's the way it'll be. Does that help you, sir? I mean, it doesn't answer your question, and I'm not trying to say you will or won't pay. I'm just trying to say, here's how it works with us.
So if I understand correctly, if the Rosebud Cooperative says, we want you to pay all of the infrastructure costs of building it, and then we'll charge you a rate according to your usage, that's something you'd be open to doing?
As I say, we will negotiate with each one to figure out the best way to get power. It's not quite that straightforward, because here Basin Electric is also the serving that's above many of the utilities, and actually that's the source of actually quite a bit of the power. And it depends. It may be a transmission line that Basin Electric's building, not Rosebud. It may be a distribution line, a local distribution line that Rosebud's building, not Basin. And so every situation is unique, and we have to sit down. But, yeah, we're open to working with the utility to find a way to make this thing work for everybody involved.
When will we know the answer to
that? I think that answer will come from Rosebud, because we won't tell you the details of our particular deal. That will be confidential between us and utility, just like your deal is confidential. Then you need to ask the utility, how does this impact? If you do this, how are you doing it, and how is that going to impact my rates? Because I'll never be able to answer that question for you, sir, because we're not the one who sets those rates.
No, I understand, but my question is, will we know from you or from Rosebud, so what arrangement you have made in terms of...
You won't know from me.
Okay, we'll go right there.
Bob Beck from Dallas. Got one quick question. Is there going to be a limit on the weight that we can cross this pipeline, like in a farm ground situation, versus like pasture round, there's no real issues of weight concerns?
Hello? Yeah, good question. I'll have John answer that.
Here, John.
Okay. As far as the farm equipment, need to look at a particular case of what we're looking at. The pipe's 4 foot deep. We need to look at what the total weight is. If need be, we can build some sort of a berm for you to cross up over the top, some specific location.
So in the instance of South Dakota here in particular, as we talked about this on the last application, understand there are grain carts and very large pieces of farm machinery. As far as this particular pipeline with the design features, there's no concern with crossing over the pipeline multiple times with that type of equipment. So normal farming equipment, typical to farming in South Dakota, there are no concerns to cross with protective measures such as John was mentioning before. I will say, however, if you were a drilling rig of that nature, you would probably need to come to us, and we need to take a look at those particulars on weights and things like that and make some sort of adjustments, as John had mentioned, with berms and such. But as far as farming equipment, no concerns with crossing over multiple times.
Hand up for questions. Go ahead, right there.
I have kind of a two-part question. John Harder, down in my area, you're going to be crossing at least three-quarters of sub-irrigated land that's highly sub-irrigated, close to ground source type water. And one is your reclamation plan for going across that is probably going to be tougher than some of the other areas. And two is when you're digging a ditch into that area where you're going to have water running into your ditch is a high possibility. What are you going to have a wider work area, or what is the process for working with areas like that? That's the first part.
Okay, now it's on. Okay. As far as water in the ditch, it comes down to whether we can keep it pumped out or whether we can't. If we can't keep it pumped out, we can look at some different construction techniques with working when the ditch is full of water. Another thing we can look at, if we, you know, as far as keeping the ditch, maybe we don't dig the ditch until after the pipe is already welded together in segments. So it's a function of whether we can keep the ditch pumped out or not. There's some different methods you can use. It's just a matter of whether it fills up faster than we can pump it out. I mean, it's that straightforward. As far as, and we'll look at what construction technique would be best suited for your particular situation. There's a possibility. Now, if we're doing a push, or we're welding the pipe up and we're pushing it down the ditch, I don't anticipate that we need more right away to do that. If we have a situation to where the ditch is caving and we have to slope it more, then there's a good chance that we would have to have a little bit wider right-of-way through that kind of an area. If it's a situation to where maybe we're going to dig the ditch after we've already welded the pipe, we might be okay with the 110-foot total. It's just a matter of taking a look at it. It's the type of soils that you have, how sloped the ditch has to be to be able for us to be able to keep it. keep it open is what the key is.
As far as the reclamation side of the question, in our application we identified that we'll be working with NRCS and each landowner to understand what your cover crop is, how you're using the land. We'll identify the specific measures that we'll implement after construction is over, whether we need to strip topsoil across the whole right-of-way or just over the ditch line. And then TransCanada has made the commitment through Keystone to monitor both for invasive weeds but also for successful reclamation of the right-of-way. So they're there for the long term to make sure whatever you want back on that right-of-way is grown back on that right-of-way.
The second part of the concern after coming out of the low areas is the soils are highly erodible going through my land, and I know south of my land because it's pretty sandy. And when you're talking like within just the pipeline area, but when you start getting, say, up to 100-foot wide strip in blow sand and it starts moving, there's nothing that you're going to be able to do about that because Mother Nature's going to take care of that. And then you got to come back and try and reclaim that land back to where it'll at least hold grass.
It's a brochure out front that talks about the whole Sandhills reclamation process. And we've started dialogue with university extension services that work with the Department of Agriculture and NRCS, Department of Transportation. They deal with this issue all the time as well. And in there you'll see there's a series of steps we'll go through to identify where those locations are. They'll be working this year to try and do as much routing as we can to avoid steep slopes or areas where we're going to have problems trying to establish reclamation. But again, the situation is that they're there. They're responsible for that right away through the life of the project. So it's not going to be a burden on you. It's going to be a burden on them to design it in a way that they can reclaim it and monitor it and make sure it holds fast.
And they'll put that in paper?
I believe that's... I don't know about the right-of-way agreements, but, yeah, it's in our application. We've already stated it. The South Dakota Commission has that.
I have a comment for the PUC, and then I have a question for the Keystone folks. I'm sure you know the feeling of farmers and ranchers about their land as citizens of the state of South Dakota. Nobody comes with an agenda. That is our investment for our retirement and for the next generation. And so there's a lot of real concern. It's not, I know maybe it sounds picky, some of our questions and the things we want to know, but my comments to help you understand what that land means to the people of this area and of the other parts in South Dakota where you're dealing with. That land is a vital, important part of just of their life and the whole community, the whole area. And thank you, and take that into consideration, please, when you think about the things that have to be done to help make this a good and proper situation for everybody. And
Ms. Miner,
to the Keystone people, I have a question. I've heard a number of times, I thought I counted four different things. I said, we will take care of that. You'll be compensated, and that's good and that's fine. And something the PSC should look at in their directives then is that it be done in a timely fashion. Nobody in this area has deep pockets, as Mr. Fine pointed out, even our Rosebud Electric don't. But the main thing is what you want to think about is a timely, to get that paid, whatever compensation is coming to people. And the only reason I'm bringing this out is the one complaint I've heard from my neighbors and friends is they'll try and get messages to you people, telephone messages, but they never get them back. They don't get answers. And this is our business, and that's your business. And in order to do good business, we all have to work back and forth together. So if it takes a ruling from the PUC and your directives, remember to put something about that in there, would you please? Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to everybody that's taken part today.
Ms. Miner, I think we need to get your name and town.
Oh, I'm on the list. I'm Doris Miner, Dallas.
Thanks. Thanks.
Have you applied, and are you negotiating with the state of South Dakota on the contractor's excise tax for this portion of the pipeline? And what kind of a refund did you get on the pipeline, East River?
The question is with regards to we applied for the contractor's excise tax for the Keystone XL pipeline project. No, we haven't, and we would plan to do so. As any major project, one of the economics when you're looking at investing nearly $1 billion, it's part of the formula. There's no question about it. But as you know, we are going to be able to provide significant ongoing benefits in property tax dollars to this state.
Bill Ferguson. Excuse me.
Hold on just a second, Mr. Ferguson. Was your answer done, or can we take in the question? Okay, Mr. Ferguson, go ahead.
Yeah, Bill Ferguson, Witten. Will there be any restrictions on tree planting across the pipeline once it is in place? And what kind of mitigation is there on long-term impact on wildlife habitat? There's more and more wildlife habitat being put in Tripp County on farms. And have you done anything to address compensation for future restrictions on of that kind?
Okay, so first, there's two questions there. I'll first answer the question with regards to the 50-foot width permanent easement and planting trees, and then I'll have John answer your question on wildlife. So for tree planting, the permanent easement needs to stay clear. That's a safety issue. We've got to be able to access the pipeline, and when we fly over the line, we've got to be able to see, get access to it. So you can replant trees up into that permanent 50-foot easement, but that 50-foot easement needs to remain clear. As for the wildlife, I'll have Joan answer.
Right now, we're working with the state and federal agencies, assessing what habitats are being crossed, and looking at how the landowner uses the land as well as what native habitats are there that are being crossed. And in the course of those studies, we work with the agencies on developing the mitigation measures that are needed. Some of those general mitigative measures are already outlined in the CMR plan that's been identified, where we work with the local agencies on seed cover mixes for temporary cover and then look at seed mixes that will also lead to long-term cover on the land. Same thing with wildlife. We have to do surveys. We have to do cultural resource surveys. All that gets factored into the federal EIS that the government will do, and it'll dictate what measures we have to do for which species and where.
John Harder, Winter, South Dakota. I'd just like to make a comment on the tax deal. We hear a lot of what it's going to save us on our property taxes, and I think everybody finds that a little hard to swallow. The last time we heard this, what was going to save us our property taxes was when we passed all the gambling to come into South Dakota. Now, we also passed a freeze on property taxes. Well, mine have went up every year that I can think of since we've had a property tax freeze, and I can't see that when we pass our gambling that it helped my property taxes a bit either. So we hear all this hype on how it's going to help our property taxes, but people find that a little hard to swallow.
Other comments or questions? All right, right over here.
I am not...
Ms. Hoffman, let's have you state your name and location.
Constance
again.
Hoffman. Thanks. And I'm not educated in all this. It feels like I'm in a poker game, and someone's really close to a full house or a royal flush or something, and I don't think it's me.
Other questions or comments?
Kyle Witten. Does TransCanada build the pipeline, or is it a subcontractor, or is it all subcontracted out, or does TransCanada officially build the whole thing?
So good question. TransCanada is the owner and operator, and we contract out to experts the physical construction of all aspects of the project. So whether it's a pump station contractor or a pipeline contractor, those specialized companies are contracted by TransCanada to build it. Now, we oversee it, so our trained inspectors watch every aspect of construction.
How many contractors can handle a project like this? I mean, is there 10 in the world or two or more?
Again, it's broken down into different types. So there are probably a couple of dozen large inch diameter pipeline contract spread companies out there. For pump stations, I believe that there's numerous of them. I think we went out to bid to about a dozen and awarded it to three for the first phase of the project. So these contractors, though, are readily available in the United States. You saw by that map, I mean, there are millions and millions of miles of pipelines. So those contractors are, you know, expertise is out there for us to solicit their work.
Thank you.
Dan Forgy, Dallas. You have a headquarters like in Yankton for the pipeline over east. Are you going to have a head place here that you call your headquarters on for this line?
Yes.
Where?
Yeah, just to clarify that slide I had, we have a U.S. operation headquartered in Houston. Our operations headquarters will be in Omaha. And then in South Dakota, we're planning to have three or four maintenance bases. Of course, we're still working on the studies that will help us figure out how many men and how many to be here and responders. But, for example, when we built the first pipeline on the east side of the state, we have two maintenance bases, and I would anticipate we'd have two additional maintenance bases for the XL project. No, we don't know where, because we haven't finished doing the analysis about where's the best place to locate these folks.
Questions or comments? We've got one right here.
I'm Ruth Lineberry, and I own land in Tripp County. Do you require that your contractors, when they bid, indicate that they will e-verify for illegal aliens? And then I have another question about are you committed to buying a lot of your supplies and construction material in the United States? I saw a CNN broadcast the other night about 50% of your pipeline is coming from India. And most of us here feel like buy America and possibly buy Canada for the part in Canada would be better put.
I'll try and answer the India pipe question. Seeing I was infamously quoted in that CNN article, and then I'll have John answer the aliens one. So there are only about a dozen pipe mills in the world that are qualified to fabricate this high-strength steel. Of those, four in the United States. In 2005, when we went out to bid for this project, the economy was booming, and every single mill in the United States was at capacity. We had no choice but to look at mills offshore. So then the remaining offshore mills, the Indian company was the one that could make our schedule and our qualifications and was up to the standard that we wanted to have here in the U.S. So it wasn't a matter of buy America or buy India or buy Canada. It was where can you even physically get it fabricated in time and delivered in time. Now, you've got to remember today the economic situation is quite a bit different than it was just a few years ago.
Ma'am, with regards to checking for illegal aliens, the contractor's proper. Most of the jobs of this size are typically done by union contractors, okay? And that means that what can happen is it, is the employment or the, you know, the credentials of everyone that works are verified by the contractor, by the unions, by the people that are brought in. And my understanding of the way the laws work now is if they find that there's someone that's working for the contractor that that doesn't meet those credentials, it's the contractor proper that gets fined for having someone that doesn't meet the criteria. So, yes, they are checked.
I'll just add that, you know, I wasn't aware of any alien issues, foreign alien issues that we had on any of our contracts. We built three spreads last year. I'm not aware that any of the contractors had an issue with that.
And I know we've got a question here, but let's just pause and see if anybody who hasn't asked a question or made a comment yet, and then we'll come back over. And, again, we're open to comments as well as questions. All right, go ahead.
You say that you're doing this in two different, like, zones. The first one's going to be at, like, 700 million barrels a day, and the next one is at 900 million barrels a day. Now, will the temperature or the pressure change when you go from 700 million to 900 million?
Yeah. Let me just clarify some of those numbers for you just because I want to make sure it's accurate. So the first phase, the capacity will be 700,000 barrels a day. And we're going to expand in the future if the market wants us to. Again, right now we don't have market conditions for that expansion, but you know, certainly we will be trying to solicit the market to expand, and that's why we're pyramiding or trying to get a permit for 900,000 barrels a day. The impact on the temperature, I'll just want to confirm with Ms. Kathari, but I believe that was based at the 900,000 permitted case.
That's correct. Everything in the application is based on the nominal ultimate design capacity of 900,000 barrels.
Comments or questions? Any comments or any questions? Yeah, Mr. Carter.
John Harder. I'd just like to say if you guys ever sell this pipeline, try and not sell it to a communist-backed country. We borrowed enough money from them.
Mr. Harder, not Carter. Sorry about that. Yep, my mistake. Right there in the back.
John Meyer from Winter. Being the president of South Dakota Retailers this year, I've been involved in about a 9-year study of tax revenues and what's coming in and out, attrition, demographics in the state. And when I look at Tripp County and I say, what are our revenues of sources of taxes in the future? What are the real estate tax possibilities? We know the shortfalls of sales tax in the state overall, revenue shortfalls. Looking at, okay, let's say the PUC, if we raise, what, $3.2 million with your company in Tripp County, does that go to Tripp County? Do those real estate taxes stay in Tripp County?
We'll look to the applicant to see if they have a tax expert that. Or
and luckily enough, commissioners, we do have one with us. Bill, I'll get you to ask that.
Is your question, do the real estate tax revenues generated from pipeline stay in Tripp County?
The pipeline and the pump stations in Tripp County.
The numbers that we use, the estimate that we have used, is local real estate taxes. Now, it's not all Tripp County. In Tripp County, you have two school districts. Right. So it's the two school districts and Tripp County.
Okay. And the other part I had was that we were talking about transmission lines and the rural electrics. Tomorrow evening is another meeting on wind power. And this is a hand-in-hand as far as I'm concerned. The transmission lines can be built, the ample amount of power and the taxes generated in this county are something we really need to get behind. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. Other comments? Questions?
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Arcorn from Rosebud. Could you list which federal laws you're going to be following? And the other question is, are you going to be consulting with the tribes?
So
Thank you for your questions. There are a number of laws. The regulations is managed by PHMSA, which is a agency of the Department of Transportation. I could get you the exact codes and standards if you want off later, because there's a number of them, and they're detailed numbers and such. So either myself or Ms. Kathari can provide you with the actual code standard numbers and such. As with consultation with the tribes, we've already commenced that process, but I'm going to get John to help explain the actual details with regards to Native consultation.
To help with the regulations, in the application itself, Table 1 of the application lists all the applicable regulations, reviews, permits that have been identified to date. The Department of State is also doing their own due diligence. And as far as Native American consultation, Department of State is the lead government-to-government agency for the Section 106 consultation. And they have started that. They sent out letters of notification. I believe they're going to have an initial meeting in May. But in addition to that, TransCanada has their own Native American consultation, which is outside of the 106 process, which they have already started and will continue to do all the way through the operation of this pipeline. Does that answer your question?
Bill Ferguson, Witten. After construction is complete, what is the anticipated local employment in regard to the pipeline in Tripp County?
Mr. Ferguson, it's a challenging question for me to answer specifically to Tripp County, because I'm not sure if the maintenance base ultimately will be here or not. But when it comes to the overall length of the pipeline, we already have an office in Brookings, South Dakota, for Northern Border. We're going to use that one. We're going to have another one in Yankton. We're now looking at possibly two offices to maintain this leg of the pipeline. The exact county locations, though, hasn't been finalized. The number of folks that we're anticipating in all of South Dakota for the Keystone Pipeline will probably be in the range of, that's permanent employees. There will also be a number of contractors that we will hire for ongoing maintenance. So the direct employment for TransCanada may be small, but then there's the contractors that we're going to continually need to maintain the pipeline.
Follow up. What are the principal parameters that you look at in choosing those sites? Not the Yankton or Brookings ones, but the ones that you mentioned you haven't located yet, as to where what factors make influence your decision on where that will be.
It's an iterative solution. I'm going to ask Mr. Hayes to respond.
I got this right? Yep. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, commissioners. My name is John Hayes, and I'm a consultant to TransCanada with specialists in specialties in emergency response and operations. We've committed through our emergency response planning for Keystone and XL to have people to respond to emergencies within 4 hours. Therefore, we will site our stations and our people along the pipeline so we're able to honor that commitment. Does that get it, sir?
You say it's a four-hour response time to get to any point on the pipeline?
Maximum.
Yes,
sir.
And that's by truck or automobile or what is the...
However we have to get there, we'll get there, but that is our commitment.
I guess that answers it well enough.
Thank you.
Frank Finney from Winter, South Dakota. You're building the same pipeline in eastern South Dakota. When will that be finished, and when will it generate some revenue for counties and school districts?
Thank you, sir. Good question. The schedule for the Keystone Phase 1 project is well underway. We built the first spread through the northeastern state last year. We're continuing to build the pump stations as we speak. And starting in May, we're going to kick off a spread to finish the construction in South Dakota this year. Our anticipation is that we'd start putting the pipeline in service by the end of the year. As for the tax revenue that will
obviously, once the pipeline is in built and in service, the tax dollars will then start to flow into the state.
Other questions? Yes, over here. Go ahead.
Just for curiosity, when Dwayne Pyle, Witten, when the pipeline is, when you're pumping oil, it's over a year, 365 days. I know it depends on the demand, but crude's going through there constantly, or is there times for maintenance, or is there...
Yeah, exactly that question. The capacities we describe are 90% of the ultimate design. So we build into our capacities the ability to be down 10% of the time. That allows for maintenance and other activities. So we don't design the pipeline so that it runs 100% of its capacity 365 days a year. So the capacities we've described are 90% numbers.
And follow up, when you initially start shipping oil from Canada, does the pump stations kick on in phases, or they all come on and stay running?
Because it's a non-compressible fluid, all the pump stations have to come on at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
Kevin Gracer, Dallas. I still have, a question on the taxes. It's an estimated $3.2 million to the county and to the school districts. Will that $3.2 million come directly to the counties and school districts, or will it go through the state, and will that stay at that figure?
Bill, I'd like you to answer that.
The Department of Revenue of the state of South Dakota determines the assessed valuation. Assessed valuation for utilities, railroads, power lines, pipelines, is done centrally. The way the system works is the valuation date is November 1st, so whatever the condition is on November 1st, just like it is for your house or your farm or your ranch. The Department of Revenue sends the number out to the local director of equalization and says this is the assessed valuation for the pipeline in Tripp County for 2010 or whatever year. Then the county, based on the county's budget, the mill levy is worked out and the tax assessment is made. And the tax assessment, the dollars are collected by the local director of equalization and stay in the county. Same is true for the two school districts in your county. When the budget's done, the tax revenue, the determination of tax revenue necessary to support the budget is worked out by the director of equalization, and the mill levies are set. So it all happens here, and it all stays here.
Mr. Taylor, we've had some numbers thrown around about what the estimated taxes would be for Tripp County. Can you reiterate that number?
I'll tell you how we did this. You have to have a starting place, and the most current numbers we could get are...
Mr. Taylor, if you could hold the mic just a little closer.
The most current numbers we could get are 2008. So we used the assessed valuation for 2008 for all the counties impacted by the pipeline. We used the assessed valuation for the 13 school districts. We used the 2008 county budgets. We used the 2007-2008 school district budgets because school districts are budgeted and assessed on a semester basis as opposed to a calendar basis. So using all 2008 numbers, we then operated on the premise that the pipeline was completed and in operation in 2008 to figure out what the tax levy would be. The tax levy for Tripp County is $672,000. The tax levy for Winter 59-2 is $1,163,000. And what's your other school district? Cologne, yeah. Cologne 59-1, the levy is $787,000. That's what the pipeline would pay. And I know the next question that comes after that is this net of state aid to education? And the answer is yes. We made the adjustments in all the mill levies to take into account the impact that it would have on state aid to education. So this number is a net number.
So I hesitate to ask this question because, you know, the taxation is maybe not in the, you know, you read the statutes about what the commission is supposed to consider, and it doesn't say, oh, by the way, you know, make sure you double-check the tax bill. I mean, the Department of Revenue and Regulation will do that. But if the estimated taxation across the entirety of the footprint in South Dakota is a little over $10 million, the numbers for the Tripp County and the two school districts seem a little high as a proportion of how much of the mileage is in those areas as opposed to the rest of the route in the state.
Well, it's all based on mileage, and we worked it out based on mileage, but it's all... The pump stations make a difference, too. The pump stations are about $20 to $25 million. And so if you're fortunate enough to be in a school district that has a pump station, you pick up that additional revenue, and that may be the difference. I can show you the numbers if you want to see.
And that makes sense. Pump stations would have a pretty big impact. Thanks. Comments, questions?
According to your map and what you stated, a lot of our refining capacities, mostly in the Gulf Coast, Oklahoma area. Now, where we're pumping this all the way from Canada down to those areas, why is it not more feasible to build refineries closer to where the oil's at and pump it in either some new pipelines or existing structures to more central areas? Because we already pump from the Gulf Coast to the center and all the way up to here. Why wouldn't it be more possible to and feasible to pump from where you're at down to the center?
Again, a good question. And so with regards to the economics or the commercial viability of the oil refining markets, they work on a hub-and-spoke basis. And so it is more efficient to have the refineries in a hub near very densely populated areas. So if you were to look at the U.S., where do you see most of the refineries? There's a tremendous number in Chicago, and there's lots built along the Gulf Coast. And then from there, they are the hubs. The spokes go out, the gasoline and diesel pipelines go out to the communities. And so if you had, for example, a whole bunch of refineries in Alberta, then you'd have, I'd suggest, hundreds of pipelines all over the United States moving diesel and gasoline. So it's just far more efficient to have the refineries at a hub logistically located to either waterborne sources where they can get their crude oil or near populations. There's also, by the way, lots of refineries up and down the East Coast as well. But there is a real efficiency to having them along the Gulf Coast between Houston and New Orleans because they've traditionally received the oil from offshore markets, in other words, from Mexico, Venezuela, and the Middle East. The other thing is that we have not sited a new refinery in the United States for well over 30 years. It's an extremely difficult challenge. So what happens is that the U.S. energy policy is motivating refiners to expand existing operations. And so, again, it makes more sense to send the crude to the existing refineries and for them to make the products we need every day.
I guess just from what I'm looking at, they got they're going to impact over 2,000 miles of this pipeline and the land it's going across versus, I think, over east they're talking 3,000 acres for the refinery over there. Is that correct? Something like that they're trying to purchase? Well, anyways, whether it's a quarter of land or what, you're looking at 2,000 miles of area that you're impacting versus if you put up a refinery in a 100-mile area. To me, it sounds like our EPA needs to think a little more.
Other questions, comments? Other questions or comments? Well, while there may be another question or comment, we'll give you a minute to collect your thoughts. While you do that, we will note that this is only the beginning of your opportunity to make your opinions heard, certainly not the end. We would be happy to hear your additional comments as this process moves forward. Certainly you can send a letter or make an electronic filing to the commission. There is more information on our website, or please contact any of our staff members, and they can let you know how you can get more involved from a legal perspective or more involved from a making your voice heard perspective. Other comments? Other questions? Yes, we've got a couple right down here.
Yeah, I'm Leo Lindeberry from over by Mission. My wife owns lands in Tripp County. And I just wanted to ask everybody if they stopped and thought about this tax deal. We all hear that everybody's pushing this. You're going to get so much from taxes. Well, I don't know about your county, but our county over there, our tax commissioners, it don't matter how much money you give them. Your taxes ain't going to go down. They just find something else to spend it on. So if you think you're going to get a reduction in taxes because you got this pipeline, think again.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Hoffman?
Constance Hoffman. Shoot, I think I forgot what I was going to say. You're involved in other energies. I thought I heard that you were involved in other energies. How are they doing?
I'll try not to make this a political paid announcement. TransCanada is a diverse company. We are in the business of transferring energy and making and developing energy. One of the biggest growing businesses we have is our power business. We're involved in wind, hydro, natural gas, and nuclear energy. So we have the ability to provide energy to electricity to millions of North Americans every day. So it's doing very well. It's one of our largest growing sectors.
Dan Forgy from Dallas. We've got some wind people wanting to build in this area. Are you against buying the power from them to run these pump stations?
Again, my understanding of how the wind electricity would go into the grid, and we would buy directly from a co-op and we'd get a rate. So if they generate wind here and it goes into the grid, yes, in theory, the electrons may end up at these pump stations. Will we deal directly with the wind generator? No, we won't be doing that.
Other comments? Questions?
Hi, Frank Finney from Winter again. Do you have a relationship with the Hyperion refinery that's been built or proposed to be built?
And the answer is absolutely not. We don't have any relationship with them. That refinery, again, my understanding is just like you folks. I read the newspaper or see articles in the news, and so I don't know anything more than you do about the status of where that project is.
Other comments? Other questions? Other comments? Other comments? Seeing none, we want to thank everybody for your patience today and thank our court reporter and the applicant. And again, if you have any other questions about this process, let's have the commission staff members raise their hands one more time. Mr. Knadel, Mr. Solem, Ms. Splitstosher, Ms. Semler, and Mr. Binder. And with that, we'll stand adjourned. Thank you very much.